Right, are you ready?
We can't just wait forever for you. I mean, everyone else is listening too. We can't just hold everyone else up because you're not ready, can we? Look, you've had long enough. We're just going to have to start without you.
Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Hey, I've got an idea. Should we start with Dave's klaxon?
What, like a massive important klaxon?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only way to start. Wow.
That sound must mean that something really exciting is coming up, chaps.
I can feel it.
Barely contain myself.
It is really exciting, but I've also got the feeling that we might have quite a few listeners coming in that haven't listened to us before. And
don't know the full range of noises that come out of my body on a daily basis.
I'm going to have to go through our entire back catalogue to make sense of that klaxon noise and position it within the context of the... Don't get me wrong, Dave. It's a great noise. It really is.
It's one of my favourite noises.
It very much stands alone to signify the excitement of what we're going
to
talk about.
I don't get to use it all that often because I'm not often this excited.
I would imagine it startles people, like if you're just in the deli counter at Tesco's
or
something.
Or if I've run out of things to say when I'm at the old folks' home visiting my gran.
Not a place to...
Yeah, gran, have you heard this? Oh, call an ambulance.
Yeah.
So why the klaxon, Dave? Dave, why the klaxon?
Because I'm so excited about what is about to happen. Because the second... let's give it a big fanfare, shall we? And call it what it's really called.
Yeah. Give it the full title.
It is time for the second annual Failing Writers Podcast writing competition in association with Scrivener is launching right now.
Right now.
Yes. So, it's your chance. Anyone who's listening, it's your chance. Anyone who's not even listening.
How would that work?
I don't know how that would work, but... And it's open. I'm just trying to make the point. It's open to everybody.
Even if you don't know it exists.
Even if you're not listening.
You can enter.
Exactly.
The ultimate competition.
If you're on the other side of the world and you've no idea what a podcast is.
You know how they say on things, no purchase necessary for competitions. This is like no awareness of its existence necessary.
Just enter.
We are nothing if not inclusive.
Absolutely.
7.5 billion people are eligible to enter this competition. In fact, the only three people in the world who are not eligible to enter this competition is us three.
What a stupid competition. How's that
fair? I know. Hang on. We've been trying to get ourselves into writing.
We're the ones that are doing all the work for it as well.
We've contrived a whole podcast to encourage ourselves to write, and we've created the one thing that we can't actually enter. And we wrote the rules.
Man.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, there's a £300 top prize. There's runners-up prizes because we're being sponsored by Scrivener, of copies of Scrivener as well, which is a fantastic, if you don't know.
Great prize on its own.
Yeah, exactly. Fantastic writing software that really helps you kind of get everything in order. We've talked about it before, and we are big fans of it.
Converts.
Absolutely. And on top of that as well, even if you don't win, you can go onto their website, literatureandlatte.com, and using the code FAILING, you can get 20% off.
Oh, wow.
So
that's good.
It's a win-win-win-win-win situation.
Yeah.
So they're getting behind us, so we can put in a massive prize pot, and we just want to hear your stories. So the stories, it's a 500-word love story competition. And we said last week when we kind of mentioned it, it's very much love is a theme, not a loose theme, isn't it? Yeah. So do with it what you want, as long as it involves love.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be a classic romance.
It can be.
It could be.
It absolutely could be. In fact, I very much like a classic romance.
You do.
However, as long as its main theme is love, we're happy.
It doesn't have to involve trees or anything.
No.
There's another. You're going to have to listen back to actually most of the episodes to get that reference. But if you do, you'll probably have a mild chuckle. I don't know if that's worth 28 hours of your time or not.
But it could include any flora, fauna, robots, demons, whatever. As long as there's some sort of link to love in it, that's good enough for us.
I was just saying the other day, there's not enough robot love stories.
There aren't.
Is there?
No.
No, that is really true.
We could have just opened the floodgates. Yeah. For robot love.
But Tommy, tell me, how much does it cost to enter?
Well, unfortunately, because of the increased prize fund and obviously all the extra work we've had to do, last year's was free to enter. This year is also free, because that's the best way to do these things, isn't it? It's not, We want as many entries as we can. We want to get people involved. We want to get people to enjoy writing. That's what this whole podcast is about.
It's a proper competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. It's open for...
Can we jump on what all the advertisers are doing at the minute and call it an inflation-busting entry fee? Because it's just totally free, isn't it? And also, the £300 prize might just about cover...
You could run an electric oven for at least 20 minutes on that.
Exactly,
that's enough to cook a pizza, isn't it?
Yep.
Let's talk about what else you get for first prize, because you've got your £300, that is safe, right?
What else do you get?
But you also get your story turned into a beautiful professional audio production. And that will play out on this podcast. That's the real prize. Yeah.
Last year's was actually amazing.
Good, wasn't it?
It was.
I know we did it and we probably shouldn't say that and be more modest, but it was.
It sounded really good. Yeah.
It was really, really good.
So we've got our theme. It's 500 words maximum word count.
Should we get on to the deadline?
The deadline, yes. When do they have to be in by?
Because, of course, there is an end to this competition.
All good things come to an end.
You have until September the 19th. 2022.
Yep.
Midday GMT.
Yes.
All right. So get them in before then. Get them in before then. Otherwise, they don't count.
It's not just about the theme and the word count, John.
No.
There is something very specific that has to be written in each entry. A little phrase that you have to include in order for your entry to be eligible.
And what is that phrase, Tommy?
That phrase is, "Ooh, Mrs., I've slipped over and it's gone right up."
So just weave that into your romantic story.
No, hang on. There are people tuning out now and just quickly writing that down. That is not true.
No.
That is not true. Tommy's just being silly.
Tommy's being silly because there is a small possibility that he can't actually remember the phrase that we are going to put in there. And that phrase, John, is...
soft as a kiss.
Yeah, and I think I like mine, actually. I don't know if we should.
No, so there we go. It is a story with a theme of love in some way. It doesn't have to be a romantic love story. It would be nice if it was, but any story about love.
No, I think if people are just tuning in for this one to hear the phrase, if you skip back a couple of episodes to when we talked to
Janice Horton,
the romance writer, we actually did some stories for that. That wouldn't fall into the normal romance category, but did involve love.
I don't think they'd fall into any category.
Possibly not.
Really,
but that's the point, Dave. They could have been entered into this competition.
That's true.
So there's a pretty wide net on this. As much as it's love stories, it doesn't have to be romance. It could be unrequited love.
It could be horror, to be fair.
I suppose it could.
But it just needs to have the theme of love. It needs to be about love.
Yeah, simple. But not all things in life are that simple. Some things are complicated. And
it feels like a Dave segue. Where are we going?
Some things in life are complicated and difficult to explain. Like some sort of strange coincidences happen in life. And it's difficult to get your head around.
I'm with you now. Yeah.
Have you ever had any sort of coincidences like that, John?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Dave, because if you go back to the last episode... I tell her an interesting little story about a coincidence.
That was more than an interesting little story. That was a fascinating little story.
A weird little story. So, in fact, that might be the best thing to do. If you haven't listened to last week's episode...
Yes, you need to listen to
I would listen to that first. Yeah. I mean, you'll be able to catch up fairly quickly, but listen to that first, trust me. And that will explain why this week... we don't just have one John Rand on the show, we have two. For those that missed last week's episode, John, just for the record, please can you confirm that your name is in fact John Rand?
My name is in fact John Rand.
And like me, is that short for Jonathan?
It is.
And like me, did you study theatre at university?
I did.
Wow.
Already weird.
Can I ask a question? New and improved American John Rand, what shoe size are you?
12 or 13, but I don't know if it translates.
Ah, right.
If it's the same sizes, but US 12, 13.
I happen to know, because I was going to ask the same question, that a 12 is an 11,
it's an 11 UK
and
size.
I am an 11.
That's just ridiculous.
Another one to add to it. And... so, just a couple more things. Like me, your Facebook profile picture was a photo of you wearing an inflatable ballerina fat suit back in the year of 2008, I believe. Is that correct?
Confirmed.
Wow.
Confirmed.
Madness. And like me, your granddad was a carpenter, I believe.
That's also true.
And he died in the last week of February 2010. Sadly, the
right
same.
Right around there, yeah.
Yeah. So, wow. So can I ask you a very personal question? Are you in fact me in a parallel universe? Be honest.
Can we delay on the? I feel like if I say that now, people would just tune out and not listen to the rest of
you're probably
conversation.
Right.
So can we punt on that?
Yeah, that is a really good call.
I mean, you can't be identical in everything, can you? Really?
No, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Otherwise, it wouldn't be. It'd be the same universe, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be parallel.
Yeah, American John Rand. Are you a talented writer?
I am a writer. I leave the talented description to.
That's a yes. See, I knew there'd be stuff that was different.
Easy. We find a difference in the end if we asked enough questions.
But you are actually a talented writer, aren't you? Because you're a very, very successful playwright.
It's been my career for a few decades now.
And actually, it's quite a hard thing to pull off, isn't it? Being a professional playwright, because it's quite difficult, A, to make money in theatre, and B, to be a writer. So I'm guessing that must put you in a very tiny percentage of people who write plays.
Yeah, it's something that I never lose sight of how rare that is, and I'm not, I'm sure we'll get into it, but I'm not sort of a standard playwright. I think the 95% of playwrights, at least in the US that you might speak with, they're writing a very different kind of play than the plays I'm writing. So, and the plays I'm writing, because it's a very different kind of play that I write, I've been able to make a consistent career of it for a long time. But I kind of lucked into writing the kind of play that I write. And still, when I go and meet new people, I think I get the, whether it's visible or not, I get the, oh, you're a writer. And then the sort of eye roll or yeah, or the sort of subtextual eye roll that, okay, what do you really do? What's your day job?
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about the particular kind of theater that you write and how it kind of began, how it all came about.
Sure.
Because I don't think we've had a playwright on the show before. I think, am I right in saying that, chaps? I think
absolutely. No. Yeah. No, this is a first.
So it's all connected, both how I started and why I ended up in this sort of niche within a niche that I'm in. So I started writing. I never really wrote anything. I guess I technically wrote a play when I was 11 or 12, but it's I would never show it to anybody. But when I was 17, oh, actually back up. When I was 14, I decided to try acting. So I was in the plays and the musicals, but never really considered writing anything. And then there were these enterprising students that started this evening of short plays that was fully run and created by the students. So it was student acted, student directed, student produced, and student written. So there was just a teacher there just for legal reasons, but otherwise students did everything. So when my brother, I have a brother who's 3 years older than me and a sister 3 years younger than me. My brother was one of the writers in that first ever evening of short plays handled by the students. So, but I was in some of those as an actor, but when I was 17, I thought, my brother wrote one of those, maybe I'll give it a shot. And so I, you know, waited till the very last minute, as is, you know, as writers do. And I banged out a short comedy and submitted it to the, I don't even know what they called it, the sort of evaluation committee. And it was selected, and then it was directed and performed. And it was great. It was exciting. And that was kind of it.
Was it better than your brother's plays?
Ooh, yeah. Well, that, see, I would argue no, but that became a question later. I'll put a pin in that. But basically, what I had written was a play that was producible by my fellow students, which is not something. Most of the plays out there in the world are hard to produce by, you know, 10 to 12 teenagers, especially where I lived in America, where there's a lot of lines you can't cross.
Right.
And so it was kind of the content, the size, the ease of production, all those things is pretty rare. And so I ended up falling into this world of writing plays that schools want to produce.
Right, okay.
And was that first play kind of the beginnings of Check Please?
Yeah, well, my first play was called Hard Candy, and it was a series of job interviews gone horribly wrong. And Check Please was my second, kind of around my second play, and I wrote that. That was a series of blind dates gone horribly wrong. And so I kind of used the structure of Hard Candy, my first play, and thought, well, that went well. Let me, instead of trying to go a totally different route, let me at least use that structure as a baseline. And then I forget who said this, but they said, if something's working, like, there's no shame in staying in your lane. And it was, since the first play was working, I thought, well, I had fun writing that. Let me not reinvent the wheel. Let me keep a similar structure, which would be sort of two-person scenes, easy to produce, comedy, short, and do that for blind dates. And that was Check Please, my second play.
Right. I think Terry Pratchett used to say something like that, didn't he? About, you know, if something's working really well, stick with it. Hence the huge amount of Discworld novels.
And everyone a winner.
And
well,
everyone a winner, yeah. So it did him all right.
I don't think there's any shame in that. I think, I'm probably thinking of, who was it? Oh, Jeff Ross. I think someone told Jeff Ross, who's like the king of roasts. There, you know, he became the, you know, if they had a roast where they mock someone relentlessly, like, he's the guy.
Right.
And I think some comic, I think, I forget which comic told him, he was kind of feeling like, gosh, I'm getting pigeonholed into this one corner of comedy, and the other guy's like, what are you doing? Of course, that's great. Yeah. Like, you're the guy everyone calls first. That's not a bad thing.
Thanks for listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. Please do remember to spread the word and tell everyone just how fantastically amazing the podcast is. Yeah, no, but it's just a little white lie, isn't it? Can't do any harm, can it?
That play you wrote when you were 14, does that still exist? That isn't the one you were just talking about then, the Hard Candy. That's
no, the other one totally is called one. Nightmare on Sesame Street, and it was not.
I love it already.
It was exactly what you think.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It was a dark twist on Sesame Street.
Oh, I see. I love that. Does it still exist? Is it in a drawer somewhere or on a floppy disk?
It's in a drawer. It's probably going to stay in the drawer, but it's in a drawer somewhere.
I love it. I can see that working as
brilliant.
Hey,
Bert, good animation.
Diary. Perfect.
See. Okay, now I'm taking that out of the drawer.
Yeah, definitely. You need to dust that one off.
Revival.
Do you know any animators or puppeteers?
I do. Tell me. Actually, one of my friends we performed in plays and musicals in high school. He was a successful animator with Adult Swim and Cartoon Network, I think, and he just had an animated series on Netflix that's coming out soon.
Right. Oh, wow.
Really talented guy, Merrill Hagen.
There you go. I can't believe on the back of like the popularity of Avenue Q, you didn't get that one out of the drawer.
Yeah, actually, I should consider some sort of lawsuit. I bet you that they got it from my, yeah.
Almost certainly got it from you.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah, yeah.
This opens doors.
That's what we're here for. So the other guys, Dave and Tom, have been writing a little bit of theatre recently, weirdly.
Yeah, another strange coincidence, isn't it?
I was gonna ask you how is it different? How is writing theatre different to writing other things, do you think?
Well, so I've tried my hand at a few other kinds of writing, and I think one of the things is that there's certain parts of, say, film and TV where you can take a few shortcuts that are, I often wish I could take, where you can rely on voiceover or a close-up or sort of a really small moment that you can, where it's not as easy to make that happen if someone's in the back row of the theater.
You might have
to say more than you show. That said, sometimes you don't want to say too, you still want to, it needs to be subtext and you don't want to spoon feed the audience, but there are more opportunities to show. There's more opportunities. You have to you can't necessarily jump from setting to setting too quickly because, you know, of the technical limitations of the stage. There are other tricky parts to it, but I think there's an element of absurdity that's more acceptable on the stage. So I think a lot of especially my earlier work is clearly derivative of The Simpsons and Monty Python. And I think that kind of material on the stage kind of plays better. You know, when it's a little bit hard to believe, and, you know, my play Check Please is maybe, I don't know if this is the best example. I mean, there's a lot of moments in my plays that are, I think if they were on on screen, they would just, people would just kind of think it was just far too over the top. But on stage, I think there's a lot of, because especially when these, they're often teenagers playing adults, there's a a bit of a free pass that sometimes audiences give, like, well, we're already suspending disbelief to a pretty big degree. Let's just look away and enjoy.
So do you think as an audience you're able to suspend your disbelief more in a theater?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think there's an, I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but I think often in the theater, yeah, you go in, you know, it's, I mean, I will say some of the best theater, you forget you're in a theater, obviously. And I don't think I write plays that fit that set of parameters. I think most people, when they see my plays, they know they're in a theater. It's more like sketch comedy.
Right.
But I love going to see a show where I'm transported and forget that I'm in a theater, unless someone's phone rings and then you remember. Mm.
What's the hardest part of writing for you, John? Is it the initial idea? Is it forcing yourself to sit down and, you know, crack on with it? What do you find the toughest bit?
I would say that second. I would say column B, and I think that's pretty common. I would guess you poll a lot of writers, regardless of the kind of writing, and that's probably the response. I don't struggle with ideas too much. I mean, sometimes I do, but I don't really struggle with writer's block so much, because I just think you just write down enough ideas. Mm. You write down a giant list of ideas, and something's bound to pop out of that list at some point.
Yeah.
But the actual act of sitting down and ignoring the noise and ignoring your self-doubt, doesn't matter how long you've done this or how, you know, if you make a career out of it, you still, you know, especially that first draft, you just keep telling yourself, this is absurd. This doesn't work. This isn't funny, or this isn't cohesive and all the rest. And then, you know, like I tell young writers, and have to remind myself all the time, the first draft is always terrible. I mean, there may be exceptions, you know, through history. But yeah, I think there's a Hemingway quote I used to have on my desk, which is something like, for every 100 pages of writing, like, one is maybe a masterpiece and the rest is just dreck. I mean, I forget the exact wording, but if Hemingway, you know, if his ratio was 99 to 1, that bodes well for the rest of us. So yeah, just sitting down and barreling through that first draft is even now, knowing that it's going to be trash, that's still the hardest thing for me.
Yeah, that is something that we hear an awful lot from the people that we talk to, because it requires a certain amount of sort of stubbornness, really, just to kind of keep going through that first draft.
Yeah, but I do think that I get so much joy out of editing. I get so, and I maybe over edit, where I'll try to refine and make, you know, one bit of dialogue, I really want it to sound exactly right. And to me, that there's so much, it's so much easier and more fun to do that than to kind of ignore your self-critic and bang out the first draft.
So do you have like a group of actors you have access to sort of trial things ever? Is that something you ever do?
Yeah, I would say that's one thing that I try and do every time after I feel like a script is getting close, which is to sit down with a group of actors. But it's varied a bit. I would say in recent years, it's either been, I would say the most common approach I take is, because these plays are almost always performed by ages 14 to 18. That's not always true. There's I don't know the percentage exactly, but there are plenty of elderly people or people, you know, anywhere from near deaf to, you know, even ages 5, 6, 7 that perform the plays. But for, by and large, we're talking about 14, 18 year old people. And so I'll usually have a partnership with a local school and a drama teacher and say, okay, let's work on this together. And usually the teacher's excited to do it because everyone wins, right? These students get to experience what it's like to read a script for the first time. So that's good training for them. It's exciting because they're a part of something in its development, and the teacher doesn't have to prepare a lesson plan that day. And I can hear the words. And that's something, another bit of advice I give to a lot of young playwrights. I say, your play is not done until you hear it out loud. I mean, and you learn so many new things. You're, oh, that monologue is completely worthless. That's just, I thought it was important, but it's not. Or that bit of dialogue is redundant to that bit of dialogue, cut that. And usually the play is several pages shorter as a result of realizing that out loud certain moments are completely useless or just don't land. Yeah.
I think that might be true of novels, to be fair, as well. I think hearing things out loud really helps, just to just to make sure that it scans, you know, that it doesn't sound clunky. It's got a sort of nice, you know, musical sound to it. I think it really helps just to turn things into words out loud.
A novel sounds so daunting to me, but I'll take your word for it.
Have you ever tried to write a novel?
Never. I worked on something of a memoir, but I just can't find my voice for it. And I don't know if it's because I'm so accustomed to dialogue. So I might try to figure out some shortcut where I can make, or some sort of cheat where I can use someone else's voice or I don't know. I've been toying with
maybe first person for the whole thing.
Perhaps
maybe.
You could use John's voice. Use another John's voice.
I've heard he has a voice that can be monetized.
Now, I think they said monotone. John. Sorry. Do you get to sort of see your plays performed a lot? Do you get to see the same play performed by many different people in many different ways?
I do, yeah. I mean, obviously, I assume it's pretty known that for the last few years that was harder than it's ever been. But even then, I got to see a lot of virtual productions. But yeah, it's a blessing and a curse too, because you know I'm writing the blueprints for the theater. Unlike a finished product for, let's say, you write a song and you record it and everything. I mean, there's an amount of collaboration, but a lot of it is in your control. Well, with theater, once it's out there, it's out there, and so you'll see a wide range of quality. You'll see stuff you're really proud of. You'll see stuff that's where you can find little moments that are of high quality, and you'll see absolutely terrible productions of your play. And then that's hard.
Yeah, it must be an odd thing, because I've got sort of limited experience of like writing something and then it being on the radio or on TV and thinking, oh, that's not quite how I would have done it. But presumably...
I think you're being nice, Bert.
Yeah, okay, I would not have definitely done that. But like with a play, I guess it's every... Are you thinking every time, oh God, I hope they get this right, or no, bloody hell, they've murdered that line, or do you just have to let things go and say, right, it's done, it's out there now, it's over to them?
It's more the latter, and I think that, and it cuts both ways, because sometimes I'll see a production where, Checklist is probably the best example, because it's one of my first plays, it's been my most popular play for 2 decades, and I have a very strange relationship with it, because I wrote it when I was very young. I don't know how I feel about it. I think it's the style of writing and the style of comedy is not my style now.
Yeah.
So I see productions where sometimes, you know, I'll see a totally bare bones production that's really stripped down and totally different from how I expected. And then I'll see a massive, like I saw a production in Florida I wrote Check Please, and then I wrote 2 sequels, and I think it was all 3 in one night, and they had a full, like, full brass band on stage, all the cast was on stage, and it was this massive, like, almost concert event, and it was great. But it's not, I never wrote it that way.
Yeah,
but when it comes to then seeing, sometimes I'll see one of my plays and I'll think, you know, that's on me, you know, like I get frustrated and I'll see a moment or a line, and I've seen it now 3 or 4 times, and I'll say, wow, that I feel bad. I put them in a tough spot, either because it's a poorly written moment, or it's just I feel terrible because it's some just goofy slapstick bit that I almost never include in a play. Like there's a play of mine where someone has to lick someone's bare foot, and I just every time I see that I think, like, that was that's mean that I put all these people through that, and I it's not my style to do that. But no matter what, it's always a thrill to meet the cast and crew and the director, everybody after the show, and there's almost always something to be proud of from that experience, and it's rare, like you said, it's rare to meet a playwright, but it's also most produced playwrights are dead or long dead. So people aren't
so
expecting.
So you're winning there. Yeah,
exactly. So far, so good.
John, talk us through your writing routine. We're just asking you before about what bit you find the most difficult, and you're saying it is, you know, it's just getting and sitting down and actually doing the writing. But tell us about where do you actually do your writing? What is your routine?
Well, that's changed a lot recently too. And one thing I used to do, and it was easier, and I'm going to get back into it once. And now that things are opening up a bit more, but I would take a notebook, or especially early on in the process, I would take a hard copy notebook, a pen, and I would take an old school flip phone, and I would just have only my family and the school have it so calls are forwarded to that phone, and I would leave everything connected to the internet at home.
That's clever.
And I would just go to a coffee shop or usually a library, and I would just, all you can do is stare at the page. You can't check social media. You can't, you know, scroll through your text or your photos, or there's all sorts of things you can do. And I'm a big believer in pretending it's 1982 and you have to write. You can't, no excuses. You just have to write.
And how often are we talking? Is that like a daily routine for a few hours, or does it depend? I guess it depends what stage you're at.
Yeah, it kind of depends. I've got two young children, and it depends on the time of year. It depends on the project. I wish I could say that I had, I'd like to say that I have a consistent routine that always works and I never stray from it. But to be honest, I'm often, you know, okay, today I have to stay home. So, and then of course, you know, I'll fall into the usual traps of, well, you know what, I should probably do laundry. But I will say that that going for a walk often helps. People ask, how do you kind of dislodge the ideas or try to get over writer's block, whether you think it's real or not? And I'd say just getting away from your desk is useful. So yeah, but in terms of routine, I'll be honest, it's not as consistent as I'd like to admit.
Well, you're not alone, mate. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Just out of interest, you don't have two boys, do you?
No. Oh, is this where we're gonna? This is the big disappointment, isn't it? I have a boy and a girl.
Yeah. Oh, damn. But yeah, have you called them Theo and Joel?
Theo was up there as one of the considerations. No.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Theo was up there. But for everyone else, for the non-John Rands in this call, and I've been, you know, ever since we had this shared moment of the inflatable ballerina suit and the others, I just assume, because the one thing you didn't mention yet, other John Rand, is that I would get your emails constantly.
Oh, yeah.
I still get them every few months, but it used to be a couple times a week that I would get your emails from business colleagues or family thinking they were emailing the other John Rand.
I had something to ask you then. It's completely...
Is it about an email that you never received?
No, it was unrelated. Yeah.
Last Wednesday, did you get an email about...
I've come really close, by the way, when I get, because most of the emails are from, I'm assuming it's not revealing too much that, yeah, the John Rand, you're a talented voiceover artist.
Well, I'm a voiceover artist. Yeah.
And I would get emails from some producer saying, hey, John, can you record this voiceover for this, you know, laundry detergent or whatever? And I've come really close to just recording something and sending it over and just seeing what happens. I was really close one time. So
I think technically, John, they would have to pay you because they've asked you to do it.
Yeah.
You've provided, true. You know, you could make a nice little sideline from that.
I can't tell you how many invoices I have in my archive. I should just send them in saying they're unpaid.
I can't believe you didn't. I definitely would have done that. Yeah. Have you seen Tom, Dave? I'm starting to get a bit worried now.
No, he was here and then he's just like, he vanished.
Must be working hard on the novel.
I mean, that sounds somewhat unlikely, knowing Tom, but I mean, it could be possible.
Wonder how he's getting on. Not that well, I would imagine. He's left all his blummin' sticky notes here.
That is a massive pile of notes.
Ugh, blimey.
Whoa.
You're not wrong, Davey.
What?
I think my notes might be getting a bit out of hand.
Tom, what, are you actually living in there now? Like, in the pile of sticky notes?
It's the only way, mate.
Do you want to tell him, John, or shall I?
It's probably funnier if we leave him to it.
Tell me what?
You should be using Scrivener.
Organising a complex document and story like this, that's what it does, mate.
Yeah, it makes it all more, like, manageable.
Yeah, unless, like, you're a weird grown man living in a pile of notes.
You can pin research to the document, make notes as you go, drag and drop chapters around, and loads more.
I have to say, that does possibly sound like it has some advantages over my system.
And there's no excuse for not trying it because they do a 30-day free trial.
Right, yeah. And imagine you were delivering the last line in a humorous but informative commercial about Scrivener. How would you chaps go about that?
I'd probably say something like, just go to literatureandlatte.com. You'll find it all there. you know, something like that.
And if you like it, which you will, you can get 20% off the full version using the code FAILING.
Tommy, you still got a sticky note on your head, mate.
Oh, no, leave that one. That is the vital foundation stone in this entire structure that I mustn't forget to lay down before I begin the process of building... Oh, no!
My beautiful sticky note home.
John, I was going to ask, going back to what we were talking about at the start, about your kind of formative years in writing plays with the masterpiece and future Broadway success of...
Nightmare on Sesame Street.
Nightmare on Sesame Street,
yeah.
Which I want to know more about that, actually, as well. very intriguing. I think that's something you need to get back out of the drawer and work on. Was there a moment, a light switch moment for it? Did you see a play at school or go to the theatre? Was there a point where it just suddenly sparked into life for you that there was...
That's a good question. I think theatre in general, I would probably point to two moments. One, so my grandfather, the one that the other John Rand referenced earlier, he worked in New York City. He was mostly
set building.
Yeah, he's built sets for Broadway shows. Yeah. He was a stagehand. He was the head carpenter for the New York City Ballet. He worked at the New York City Opera. So he was just he was this carpenter extraordinaire. But when we would go visit in New York as kids, you know, he would take us to backstage at the Nutcracker, and we would see everything happen, all the magic, but we would see how the magic was created. And I think that was big, just to see, here's the show, but here's the show that you don't see. And then I would say my parents, love theater, and they still do, and they would take all their kids to see, you know, the local, we had, I think, one professional theater, and they would put on musicals, and so we would see, I still remember there was a musical, when I don't know how old I was, but there was this musical called 1776, and I remember sitting in the front row and just being completely entranced by it all. So I think, and then when my brother was in high school, he was performing a play, and I would go backstage and I would be entranced by that. So I think just over time, I knew I would at least give it a shot when I was old enough to, and had like a scrap of confidence to at least give it a shot. And so, when I was 14 is when I decided, okay, it's time to at least try.
So you were captured by the magic of it all. Like a proper romantic story of...
Yeah, no, theater is often terrible, so it could have easily gone the other direction.
Could have scarred you for life,
exactly.
I guess it turned out this
Still
way.
Could. Still could.
What do you think, not wishing to, but keep going with the doppelganger stuff, but... What are your views on, I don't know if you've heard of a guy that writes quite a lot of plays or did, William Shakespeare?
Heard of him, yeah. He's all right, yeah. It's interesting you say that because I have these moments from when I was a kid. So a few things. One, I had some amazing teachers when I was a teenager, and they would goof around with Shakespeare in a lot of ways. So when I was, I think, a sophomore, so I don't know if a lot of this stuff translates where you are, but when I was 15.
Yeah.
Okay. So as a sophomore in high school, my teacher, Mrs. Hall, she would have us perform, Shakespearean plays in fun ways. And so we would have these in-class projects where we would sort of come up with parodies of Shakespeare.
Oh, cool.
And then when there's a three-person play called The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged that I think premiered over on your side of the pond.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that.
If I'm not mistaken. And I performed in that when I was a senior in high school. And that was one of those transformative moments for me because it was just three people, and you just kind of barrel through every single Shakespeare play. And I think that led to an appreciation for the Bard at a young age. So I think I have at least a few plays that toy with Shakespeare and kind of riff on it.
What's your favorite?
Favorite Shakespeare? Wow. I'm trying to think of, I don't want to say anything that's too generic, but I do love Hamlet. I just, something about it. It's such an obvious choice, but I love Hamlet.
It is pretty great. Yeah. I think maybe King Lear is a bit of a killer one. Although it does leave you a little bit down in the dumps at the end. Mind you, Hamlet's not exactly uplifting. But
Dave Dave, do you know any Shakespeare plays that you could just say one out loud so it sounds like you've got a favourite?
Do you know what? I prefer his earlier stuff before he was signed.
Yeah.
That people don't really know much about.
I will say, a lot of people, there's a lot of great films, and I'm a sucker for Shakespeare in Love, and I think people think like, oh, I can't, you know, that was, come on, that play, that movie, I forget the Academy Awards that year, I think was it, maybe that one over... Was it Saving Private Ryan or something? And everyone's like, oh, that's nonsense. And I love that movie. I can't get enough of that one.
That's good.
What about you, Tom? You've never told us your favourite Shakespeare.
Well, it's pretty tough to choose, but I would probably have to go with the only one I've ever read, which is The Merchant of Venice.
Well, there we go.
Oh, that's a quality one.
Is it?
One.
We had to read it at school. So
did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, actually, yeah. Did enjoy it. Yeah. Apart from the bits where Shakespeare tried to say something funny. And he isn't funny.
No.
Do you know where the kind of teacher goes, that bit was a joke. And you think, God, no, he's saying he's like the best playwright of all time, but if you have to stop the reading and tell the class that was the joke, he's maybe not funny.
His puns probably don't work quite as well as they used to be fair.
Not really. And to be fair to him, a lot of his clever little bits of language have just become so ingrained in our language anyway that they've lost their actual... meaning or novelty.
Yeah.
So
they become,
do you mean,
cliches and yeah. In the
three or 400
right.
years can ruin a joke, I think. Comedy is all about timing. 300 or 400 years is too long.
Well, you asked before about like, you know, when I go see my plays, and that's a problem too, which is that I've seen these jokes dozens and dozens of times, and when you know the punchline, I mean, how could you ever actually enjoy it?
I thought you were going to say, so now I feel really embarrassed about laughing out so loud, but I feel that I need to get the audience, get everyone else
exactly.
going. Oh, that's hilarious. Isn't that clever?
There's a story. I'm not going to say the name of the school for fear of, I don't want to ridicule them, but there was a play of mine that I saw. And this is a mistake that a lot of young performers make, which is they get laughs that first day of rehearsal. But then the laughs sort of subside. And so they feel like they have to sort of add. And so they'll add some random accent, or they'll start to roll around on the floor for no reason or something. So I was at a production with my wife of one of my plays, and it was total chaos, right? Everyone was just, it didn't make any sense. It just, and I bet it did on day one of rehearsal, but by day, you know, 45, it was just...
They're just,
you know,
escalating
noise.
Everything, yeah.
So there was this people, like a few seats down, one leans over to the other and says, I have no idea what's going on. And I was this close to saying, I don't either, and I wrote it. But I just kept my mouth shut.
I like to think that's what William Shakespeare would be doing if he was watching a play of his today. But like, well, I don't remember this bit. How did this happen?
I see what you did there. You tried to basically put me on the same footing as William Shakespeare, and I get that a lot. So
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
So, John, one of the things I really want to get to the bottom of...
Please say Nightmare on Sesame Street.
No.
It's really got me. I need to know.
With you being the kind of the avatar of my parallel reality, what I really need to know is what is it about you and your character, your psychology, that has made you successful at writing whilst I am definitely not? That's what I need to know. What's the secret? How can I emulate that success? What am I doing wrong?
Well, you should at a young age get lucky and stumble upon an overlooked part of a small industry and fill a gap that no one was filling. So just do that and you're good to go.
Okay. So all I need is a time machine. And I'm laughing.
Good advice. Really good advice. What advice could you give to me and what would be your sort of top tips for me and Tom in our current sort of playwriting ventures? To give you a little bit of background, we both sort of inadvertently have written stuff that originally intended to enter a competition. So that we've got two plays that started from the same sort of germ, if you like. They both had to be based around a park bench, but they're very different in style. But what sort of... little tips could you give us on the sort of playwriting?
Well, first and
journey.
Foremost, don't write a play that centers around a park bench.
Ah, that's okay.
I will say I've read a lot of plays. There's a a longer story that my brother and I started a publishing and licensing company, and we would read plays and plays and plays and plays, and that was the most common setting. But I understand why it would be part of a contest, because yeah. it was a very familiar setting, and some of the greatest plays, like it was Zoo Story, I believe, Edward Albee, I believe, is on a park bench, and that's a great one. But I would say we've already said some of that, which is you have to hear it out loud. When it comes to actually figuring out a way to, you know, once you feel like the play is ready, how to get it out there in the world, I don't have a good answer for that anymore. When I got my start, this was pre-Google. So what I did, so to back up a little bit, when I was, you know, I was 17, I wrote this play, Hard Candy, and then I just put it in a drawer, just like everybody does. And then when I went to college, I just, I put a few scenes of my play on a website that I built from scratch, because there's no Facebook, no anything, or no Squarespace, these platforms. So I just try to kind of yeah. toy around with it, figure it out myself. And then I had to submit my website to search engines. So this is all so early internet that it doesn't translate
yeah.
to what you would do today. So I don't really know the best. I know the sort of more generic answers to give, which is, you know, you want to connect with, this isn't that generic, but I mean, the more people that you get to play in front of, the better. And whether it's those readings we talked about, I mean, that's something that one of you asked, you know, about the sort of core of actors. And that was something when I was young that I didn't realize was happening, but I was sitting down with my play or their play, or I was, you know, in the audience for a reading of someone's play, and I was, without realizing it, I hate the word networking, but I was networking, right? And so I have, you know, all these actors and directors and other writers that I've known for decades that are now, they wrote the screenplay for this incredible film, or they are an incredible director on Broadway, or, so that's, you know, it can't hurt to collaborate and help and don't be a jerk. And that sounds so sort of broad, but that's what I would tell young writers who are just getting started. Like, yeah, have a thick skin, be a good person. If you're asking for help, but you need help in return. But when it comes to actually finding success with you know, your park bench plays, I don't really have the answer. I wish I did, but I think I don't know the sort of batting average for contests. I know there are a lot of contests out there and festivals out there and theaters that are saying, we're looking for exactly this kind of play.
Yeah.
I don't know what the success rate is. I haven't really faced that because I've kind of ignored it. Because the kinds of plays I'm writing, like I said before, I'm ignoring the West End. I'm ignoring off Broadway. Mm. My plays will not make sense in those venues.
Have you been tempted to write for Broadway or to sort of move out of the sphere that you're in at the moment and try other things, screenplays or anything like that? Or is it just you're just happy where you are and it's, you know, it works well and you enjoyed writing it?
I haven't been tempted too much by Broadway or off Broadway. I am tempted by other forms of writing. That memoir that I was working on, at some point I'd like to get back into that. I wrote a pilot for a TV series that I was passing around just before the pandemic, so bad timing on that. So yeah, I would like to, you know, I started a YouTube comedy series about poker, and that was my attempt at, okay, I got this love for short form comedy, I've got this love for this newfound love for poker, and how can I kind of combine the passions? And so I created a very niche within a niche.
John, do you want to pick this one up, John? Tell him. Tell him.
Okay. While we're on the coincidences, the three of us have been trying to write a sitcom about a poker night.
I'll admit that I did notice that, and I had forgotten as I was telling you this story that is a parallel. I happened to notice, I was looking at your podcast titles and I saw Poker Night. Huh. That's which John Rand started that first? I want to find out if it was exactly the same time.
That's quite weird.
That's hilarious.
So what you mentioned YouTube as well, because for a while we had an idea that it was going to be a sort of YouTube channel.
The situation of the sitcom was going to be that it was filmed for a YouTube channel.
Yeah, a bunch of guys who sort of filmed their poker nights for a YouTube thing. But you're not talking
really.
That.
Wow, I didn't know there was that much of a parallel.
But you're talking about you would just make it for YouTube rather than it was.
So it exists, and I
how close
it exists
were the
already,
ideas?
And it's actually very few people know that the playwright Jonathan Rand or John Rand. I'm known as Jonathan Rand in the playwriting world, but that the two are connected. But they are connected. So yeah, I started this. Poker YouTube channel about a year ago.
Oh, right.
And I've been just kind of putting out little episodes since I think I'm working on episode 18 right now. So it'll take a while to make, but there are these just sort of short form variety show meets poker meets. So it's not a traditional sitcom. So that's right. Where the John Rand and John Rand parallels end.
Well, thank God for
it's
that.
It's more, I'm playing actual poker hands at the poker table.
Oh, wow.
You don't see anyone's faces, okay. But I'm kind of riffing on kind of like sort of stand-up comedies, not quite, but it's riffing on the hands, the moments, and then it's all extremely kind of rapid fire. I'll reveal it now. It's called Slow Poker, and it's Slow Poker on YouTube. Wow. But yeah, it's just my way of combining my love of short form comedy
and poker.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that's worth checking out, isn't it?
Quite weird, though.
It's weird. I don't know. We should keep track of all the connection, the John Rand connections.
Yeah.
That's, I knew more would come. And my wife and I said that when we travel, you know, abroad, the first stop is meeting John Rand. I will say, and she might throw me under the bus for this, but someone one time told me, oh, you two even look alike. And I showed my wife and she was just like, nah. And then she said, no, he's actually really cute. And so now I'm concerned, you know, that this might go south.
I thought you were going to say you're concerned about your wife's vision or she's having some kind of right? Eye problem or something. Maybe
we should get that checked out.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That sounds quite serious.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, are you up for playing a game?
Yeah, sure.
I think we should. Play a little game where I shout out some stuff, and you tell me whether we have that thing in common or not.
Okay.
Let's go. Oh, what are we calling it, by the way? You're going to come up with a brilliant name, Birdie.
Well, I don't know if it's going to be quite quick. I thought we could call it John in 60 Seconds.
That's great.
I like that one.
It's quite good, isn't it?
Yeah. That's nice.
I think we should stick with that.
That's nice.
The other one was if it gets weird, we could call it, you spin me round, right round, baby, right round, like a record baby, right round, round, round. But that's probably a bit too long.
I quite like that
better than mine, because I thought if it was about like fate and stuff like that, we could call it Kiss Me, I'm Randy. But I don't know if that comes out right.
Right, let's do this. Time for John in 60 seconds. What will be the biggest lessons? Hope we'll get some huge confessions. More likely just a lot of stupid questions. John Rand, what's best, cats or dogs?
Dogs.
What's your height?
6 feet.
Yeah, no, six, just over six. Yeah, almost 6'1". What, you were done shoe size. That's the same. What month were you born?
January.
April. Where are you living? Urban, suburban, or rural?
Suburban.
Same. Interests. Give me some interests. I know poker's one, so that lights up a little light there.
Yeah, poker's big. Oh, this is supposed to be fast, and I'm not giving you answers. I like eating. I like eating a lot.
Yeah, I like eating.
Okay, let's go with eating.
Do you like cycling?
I do like cycling.
Oh, I like cycling.
But I'm not intense with it. I draw the line at like full spandex, but I love cycling.
John's
gone the other way on that.
Okay.
What's your wife's star sign?
I should know this. I think it's Taurus, but maybe I'm wrong. I think I'm wrong. I don't really follow that stuff, so I don't know.
Say Scorpio.
May 28th. What's that?
Oh yeah, no, it's different. No, Katie's Scorpio. Have you ever been in a band?
No.
Why why are you laughing?
When I was at summer camp, there was a production of Fiddler on the Roof. And because I was such a grand thespian in high school, it was beneath me to be in the show. So I thought it would be funnier to play kazoo in the band. Yeah,
so again, no, much more talented musician. No match there.
Definitely. Favorite food? You like eating? What's your favorite food?
I don't have the answer to that. I will say this. I was raised Jewish, and I think... Mm. If the Jewish people would make one exception and allow bacon into the equation, I feel like their numbers would go way up.
Okay. Well, I've written something spicy. either a great curry or
spicy
or
bacon.
Tacos. Yeah, spicy bacon. Mm. Any allergies?
None.
Okay. Any major
Whoa, how far are you going with this?
Any major operations?
I'm going to pass on that one.
Okay.
A small one.
Okay. Yeah, same.
A small one with major implications.
Okay. What was your first job?
I worked at a bagel shop.
Cool. Okay. And how did you meet your wife?
We met at a bar in New York City.
Oh, I didn't do that.
You did get married in New York City, though, didn't you, John?
I didn't.
No, you didn't. Did you?
Oh,
no, I didn't. I was at your wedding.
Doing that?
Of course you didn't.
I was there as well.
York. I knew there was a York involved.
York. Right.
I'm just looking for matches. I'm looking for matches now.
Yeah,
I'm just
that's the
for
problem,
matches.
Isn't it? Once
American John,
roll.
Do you have eyes? Do you have eyes?
I do.
Feel like one of these secondary psychics doing a cold reading.
I need to back up, though, John, because you were born in April. So my brother and sister were both born in April, and my parents wanted to have me in April, but they there was an error. And so I...
Wow.
Do your parents schedule a lot of stuff accurately?
They do. They're schedulers. I'll get an email from my sister every April to wish me a happy birthday observed. Technically I should have been born in April, and so there is a connection there that should have been
close.
Wow,
yet so far. Well, thank you for answering those questions. I think the extent of our coincidences has probably run out.
Yeah,
roughly around
that, after
now.
After all that. American John, don't be surprised if you get a notification that a new credit card has just been opened in your name.
Didn't think of that. Oh, man, I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Do you want to know my first pet?
Yeah, first pet and your mother's maiden name, please, and then we're done with you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, John. It's been an absolute delight and very enlightening and... Yeah, and extremely pleasant.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
And it was definitely a story that needed to be told as well. Quite amazing, isn't it? But yes, thanks very much for coming on, John.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that, we've got no more information on Nightmare on Sesame Street. Is that it? We don't know.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Take care of yourself. And if you're ever on the other side of the pond, then come and see us. Come and hang out.
Definitely.
Goodbye, favourite John Rand.
What's better than one John Rand, two John Rands?
You say that, but...
Oh, no, Dave, you know what's happened here? Our plan's failed. This John Rand's come back on with us after the interview. I thought you said we were going to try and swap, like... You know.
Well, I was hoping, but it just didn't seem to fall that way, did it?
Yeah.
It's like the toss of a coin,
and
our side's come down on this John.
Yeah.
You can't get rid of me that easy.
The only thing with that interview, though, and if you do meet up with him, John, you need to, I think... For me, you need to delve into this a bit further. I don't think we got far enough with Nightmare on Sesame Street. That really did pique my interest, like massively. I don't know if I had kind of half a vision that it was going to be some like proper horror thing. So I had this image of like the puppeteers were actually forcing the hands inside like real animals. So it was like actually, do you know, like Big Bird was just an ostrich that someone was just... turning into a puppet as they went.
It's just like some
just
horrible
like a massive
abuse.
Like animal slasher.
Mm.
Yeah.
Good. Oh, God.
Yeah.
So just to leave you with that.
That is horrendous.
That nice image.
I was going to say that for a story that's basically about puppets, I think that idea has got legs.
That's indeed.
Oh, man. So, that was intense, wasn't it?
It was intense. Yeah.
It was
intense. The process
Who's that guy who wrote those films?
Which one was it, Dave?
No. Give me a minute.
Charlie Kaufman? No.
Yes, Charlie Kaufman. It's a bit of a Charlie Kaufman-esque thing, isn't it?
It was, yes, I think so.
Living inside the mind of John Rand, and then you escape, only to find that you've jumped from one John Rand straight into the mind of another John Rand.
Yeah, doesn't bear thinking about that, does it, really?
No. No, let's not linger on that. So now, by this point, everyone who's listening, if there's anyone left, has got everything they need to enter our competition.
Yeah, we should just go through that again, actually, shouldn't we? Because people will have been overwhelmed by the happenstance and coincidence of the interview in the middle.
Possibly the sheer scale of the competition as well might have blown their minds temporarily.
Maybe people think that we're joking when we say we're giving away £300.
There's £300 first prize. There's runners-up prizes of Scrivener, who have very kindly sponsored the whole competition, hence the lovely Scrivener advert in the middle of that interview. So it's a 500-word love story competition, and love is a loose theme rather than a strict genre. Yeah. So it could be romance, it could be unrequited love, it could be a lovely love story.
Yeah.
Could be.
I like them.
Yeah.
I like them.
It could be two people falling in love on the set of Nightmare on Sesame Street.
Yeah. It could be.
They're each like elbow deep in a rabbit and they're just, you know what I mean? Their eyes meet across the disemboweled innards of an ostrich.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, their bloody forearms.
Yeah, just wherever you want to take it, take it. But you do need to include the phrase...
soft as a kiss.
We were going with soft as a kiss.
I think we were.
Yeah, we'll go with that one. But all the details for entering and all the terms and conditions and all the relevant stuff can be found on our website. So if you just have a look at failingwriterspodcast.com/blog, you'll see everything you could possibly need. If we haven't laboured the point quite enough, you can read it in black and white on there.
Absolutely. So that's the 500-word love story competition from the Failing Writers podcast in association with Scrivener. £300, top prize, Bob's your uncle, get writing.
So, yeah, I think there's nothing really left for us to do other than get out of the way and let people crack on with writing. Which
I think you're right.
Kind of what this podcast was supposed to be about in the first place, wasn't it?
Well, we should just ask the question, actually, shouldn't we? Has anyone written anything this week?
And we end the podcast
there.
Goodbye,
everyone. Bye. See you next week.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?